Figure out the boundaries of space here.
Good morning. We'll convene here this morning to begin the special board meeting of the Forest Practices Board. Patricia, would you please give us a safety briefing?
Yes. Good morning and welcome to the Sherberg Building. Before we begin today, I'd like to review the evacuation process. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not. Drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can and wait for the shaking to stop. In the event of any evacuation, please leave this room using the exit doors into the hallway and out the building using the exit door at the south entrance of the building towards the sidewalk area along Water Street. At this time, I ask that you silence any noise-making devices you have and please adhere to the no food policy for this room.
Thank you, Patricia. We'll just take a couple of minutes for opening remarks here. Obviously, the board is here today to review and take stock of our scientific knowledge about landslide hazards. This is for the purpose of informing both the public and the board members as to what's known and to inform the board members in potential action items for tomorrow's business agenda. We have a full docket of presentations here today. And I'm deeply appreciative of all the folks who've joined us to make those presentations and to our staff for supporting this board meeting. It's a lot of logistical wheels turning to try and make something like this happen. So I thank you all very much for your help with that. I think it's the board obligation to, again, take stock of our scientific knowledge, to learn about the protections that are in place in the Forest Practices Rule System, to understand how we put those practices on the ground. That's the purpose of today's meeting. We do it against the context of an awful tragedy, and I think it's affected us all. It makes our work that much more important. I'll rely on our board members and your knowledge and contributions. I can hardly think of more important work for us to be doing, so I just thank you all for this morning. And with that, I'd like to begin. Our first presentation of the day is from Dave Norman, who is our state geologist in the Department of Natural Resources Office of Geology and Earth Resources. Dave's going to give us an overview of landslide hazards in Washington State broadly and the status of our inventory and detection tools.
Good morning. Thank you, Aaron, members of the board. I'm Dave Norman. I'm the state geologist with the Washington Geological Survey, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geology and Earth Resources. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the landslide hazards overview of Washington and then the tools that have been used over a period of time. I'm going to take a few minutes just to talk about the geology of the state. And to put it into context, the way that Washington, we've got a complicated state geologically, and this is a slide of the landslide provinces of Washington. This is a figure that's from a 1984 article that was done by Jerry Thorson from the Washington Geological Survey. It helps put a little bit of organization to it to try to put the context for the state. I'm going to start with the Puget Lowland, which is has some of the youngest geology. It's all glaciated. It's been piles of loose, unconsolidated materials, glacial tills that are impermeable, and has steep slopes along the bluffs. The Olympic Mountains are characterized by metasediments and metavolcanics that are surrounding the core of the Olympic Mountains, and it's partially glaciated valleys and valleys that are unglaciated as well. So that puts a different spin on the way that landslides occur in these areas. Southwest Washington is an area that is unglaciated, that has deep lateritic soils. They're weathered, and they haven't been tested by then the glaciers that have then scraped off some of the other areas. Cascades are generally divided into two provinces, the South Cascades and the North Cascades. And you can kind of see in the this geology map that this is draped onto, just the different colors. South Cascades are primarily volcanics, but still they have glacial material in the valleys, alpine glaciers, and steep slopes. The North Cascades are characterized by metamorphic rocks, granitic rocks, and extensive faulting and folding. And this area has been highly glaciated, has lots of material in the valleys as well, but it's also been tested. The materials have been tested by the glaciers then, so a lot of material has been removed. The Okanagan Highlands, again, metasediments and granitic rocks, but it's also had the continental glaciation of the Okanagan Lobe that would have pushed down and had lots of glacial material again. Lastly, the Columbia Plateau or Columbia Basin is Columbia River basalts primarily, lots of material from the glacial outburst floods from Missoula and Spokane, and down in this area here is the fold and thrust belt, which has steep anticlines and faulting again. And I'll show you that in one of the slides as we go through this, why that matters. So one of the products that has been put together is just a compilation of landslides. And this is a compilation from various materials, whether it's geological maps or other landslide studies that have been done. So although you see there's a lot of red on this map, it's there's much, much more that is out there. This is only probably a fraction of the landslides in this state. So there's 51,000 in this database, and you can see about 30,000 of those are shallow rapid landslides, and 11,000 are deep-seated landslides. We've done no significant updates on this since 2009. And this information is available on our geology portal as an interactive site that you can go and look at. Some of the primary methods of data collection then are remote sensing. By that we mean aerial photographs, oblique aerial photographs, USGS topographic maps, 10 and 30 meter digital elevation models, and LIDAR. These are the sort of the normal tools of a geologist to be able to identify landslides. And you can see just in this aerial photo that there these bare areas are where there have been landslides and debris flows. So the landslide mapping techniques that are used then are field validation. People, geologists go out to the field and look at these and create maps from them. And there's sort of a different levels of each one of these that occurs. There's a systematic method that's employed by this. There's which allows for an interpretation, and usually from several different years or vintages of air photos and digital elevation models, and then some limited field validation. You can't necessarily go to all of these just from a time perspective. You can see the red lines here where these have been delineated on this air photo. Geological mapping is another method of doing this, and that's one of our primary methods in the state survey is geological mapping as well, because it puts context into the landslides in terms of the geology and the faults of the area. And then, of course, reconnaissance is also another way to do this, and that can be just the interpretation from one set of air photos to get some of the data. So landslide detection techniques, mapping deep-seated landslides and shallow rapid landslides require very different techniques to identify these. deep-seated landslides are best observed and identified in with LIDAR, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute. And shallow rapid landslides are best observed with aerial imagery immediately after the event in western Washington because they get covered up with vegetation fairly quickly. And the landforms and using LIDAR to identify the landforms that are susceptible to shallow rapid landslides. I just put this image in to show you this the colored area, the yellow and the green here, to show you these are the areas that the geologists would consider acceptable or adequate LIDAR to do an investigation, meaning that we think this is high resolution enough to be able to answer questions. The other LIDAR that's either been collected isn't acceptable or it's not been collected. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of how this goes. Shallow rapid, so keep your eyes on the yellow dots here, and you can see that there is a couple of bare areas coming down through these areas here. And then up in here, you can't really see anything because of the trees. This is after debris flow events in 2009 up in Whatcom County, up in the Van Zandt Dyke area. And you can see that these yellow dots then were on the aerial photo are now looking at this on the LIDAR image. You can see where the purple areas are. That's what the debris flow paths that came off of this. But you can see that the green areas are also highlighted here. And the reason for that is this is a model that we use to look at areas that are steeper slopes, that have convergence, that may be landforms that have the potential for being shallow rapid landslides. These would have to be evaluated then in the field to determine more information about them. So you can see that lots of the purple areas are shown, that they kind of coincide with the green, but not all of them. So what that means is, well, they didn't fail during that event, but they still have potential. Here's an example for a deep-seated landslide and about how the information is derived for this. This is the Ledgewood landslide on Whidbey Island, not too far from Coopville. This was the 2013 landslide. So this is the aerial photo for the area, and you can, this is 2011, so this is prior to the landslide. This is the LIDAR that was pre-2013, and you can see that the LIDAR clearly shows the outline of this landslide here. There isn't any too much difficulty to map it or to show where this is on a map. So mid-2000s, a geological map was also done for this area, and this landslide was then identified on the geological map. This goes into the database and into the portal, and then is also given to the county for their purposes. So you can see the additional information is the what these symbols are, QGO, QGDM, QGT. These are all glacial units that are then also part of helping understand the what's going on with this landslide. So just to kind of go back, here's the 2013 air photo. And, you know, I think if you were looking at this, you would have identified this as a landslide. This had been identified as a landslide in previous mapping efforts that we'd done. But if you look now, here at the air photo in 2013, you can see this lobe then occurs. And it's pretty obvious, I think, to see that. But then here's 2013 LIDAR, and then this LIDAR was flown immediately afterwards, and it shows again the topography and the immediate effects of what's going on this slope. So a few other tools that are used for the systematic landslide hazard approach over the years, watershed analysis. I'm sure you're familiar with that, mass wasting module. There have been 54 projects done for landslide hazard zonation, and 54 projects for watershed analysis from 1994 to 2002. Landslide hazard zonation project, 63 projects have been done, and you can see in these green areas, this is the watersheds that have been done, looking at some sort of an approach of trying to look at the landslides. Out of that total, you can see there's 825 WOWs, watersheds, and 754 of them are forested. So some of the other systematic landslide methods that are used are we've in the mid-2000s we had funding to look at Cowlitz County to do a landslide map for that county, and that is another approach that we've done, and that's been implemented or used by the local jurisdiction, county, and the city of the area, Kelso. We also do coastal landslide hazard mapping using the methods that we talked about in terms of LIDAR or air photos and then field reconnaissance. We do 1 to 24,000 geological maps. That's what this map down here, this is a geological map. This is the Mount Higgins Quadrangle. And this is, you can see, this is the area of the SR 530 landslide. And then there's geological information that goes along with that. This was done in 2003, that quadrangle. And then something probably most of us don't think much about, but probably should. There's another approach that we use for in the geological survey. We also think about earthquake-induced landslides a lot. And so we're just completing a project along the outer coast for some of the areas for tsunami evacuation routes. So during that project, we are worried about where landslides may impact the evacuation route. So these can be significant. This happens to be down in Hoquiam River. You can see these red areas have a high potential for having a landslide during any significant earthquake. This was modeled after a magnitude 9 Cascadia event for this. It does take borehole information to do a lot of this for if you're looking at deep-seated landslides. So I bring that up because of other significant earthquakes, such as the Northridge earthquake in 1994 had 11,000 landslides from that event. This Wenchang, China, in 2008 had more than 60,000 landslides occur. It isn't something that should be taken lightly. It's something that needs to be taken into the modeling as you move forward on these. So I'm just going to, this is really just kind of a rapid, I'm going to show you some of the recent significant landslides. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about each one of these. I think most people are familiar with these. So this one, the SR 530 landslide, clearly one of the most significant landslides in the state. The Whidbey Island landslide of 2013, we talked about. It impacted about 30 homes. In 2009, the Nile landslide, fairly large landslide. It affected 9 houses, either outright damage or flooded them. And it cost about $20 million to replace the highway, and the Natchez River was rerouted, diverted. This one in Stevenson County was significant in 2007 because almost all of the infrastructure for Stevenson goes across a bridge that's downstream of this landslide that could have been impacted and would have affected virtually every service for the city. So this one is, I put this one in because of it's in eastern Washington. I don't want you to think that this is just a western Washington issue as well. This one in 2006 came across Road 170 over by Basin City area in eastern Washington in Franklin County. Again, these are lake beds in this case, sand, silt, clays. This slide is, you're familiar with this event as well. In 2009, a significant number of landslides and debris flows, 1,500 of them recorded throughout western Washington from Skagit County to Lewis. This one is from 1997. This was one of the most destructive landslides, certainly for homes and in the country. 138 homes destroyed in this deep-seated landslide. Carline Beach here in Thurston County destroyed homes for 30 families. This one you are familiar with as the Forest Practices Board. This was a 1,700 landslides recorded by us and in Lewis County and other counties. Rolling Bay, Bainbridge Island, put this in, although it's not as recent. This one killed four family members during that event. Marble Mount, Skagit County, 1985. There were four deaths associated with this debris flow. And this one is in because this is the most recent event that I know of. This was Saturday in King County. I was called to go out and look at this because this landslide had temporarily blocked the Cedar River, and it wasn't clear what was happening at that point, so I went out to look at this one. So this one, you're looking at, again, glacial sediments, a very steep face here of almost vertical up at the top and 50, 60 degrees at the bottom, and delivered about 1,000 cubic yards to the valley and blocked the river, but only temporarily for about 15 minutes. And last, from the Nisqually earthquake 2001, lots of landslide and earthquake-induced landslides. These are some of the highlight ones, but keep in mind that during the Nisqually earthquake, this area was very dry. It was one of the driest winters we'd had. If that happened now during saturated conditions, you would see many, many more landslides. And then lastly, just where can you find data and information? You can go to the geology website. You can go to the Forest Practices website, and you can get all of this data and information from those places. We also have a geology portal, and this is just a screenshot of it. This icon here has the natural hazards in it, landslides and others. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. For board members, we're going to move through these first three presentations and then bring our presenters back up for questions at the end. So next we're joined by Jonathan Gott, the USGS. And just for board members' reference, we're privileged to have Jonathan as a leading person in the USGS landslide hazard program. He comes to us from Colorado, made some personal schedule rearrangements on Mother's Day to fly out yesterday. So we're very grateful for that. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Everett. Aaron, excuse me. Yeah, I'm Jonathan Gott from the United States Geological Survey with the Landslide Hazards Program out of Golden, Colorado. I'm a research physical scientist. And I'll talk today just a little bit about the SR 530 landslide near Oso, Washington. And these are some of the statistics about that slide, which I assume you're all familiar with, but just to refresh our memories. On March 22nd, Saturday morning at about 10:30, a large, rapidly moving landslide occurred, impacting the community of Steelhead Haven near Oso, Washington, causing the deaths of 41 people. Two of those folks remain missing. The slide buried about 40 homes and other structures and covered about 0.8 miles of SR 530. The slide also temporarily blocked the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River, flooding an area of about 0.5 square miles. The search operations, the search and recovery and search and rescue operation involved hundreds of professionals and volunteers at the peak. And our role as the USGS was to support the state and the county in the life safety operations for those folks. So to provide a hazard assessment on the fly to ensure that there wasn't renewed landslide activity that would threaten those search operations. The landslide displaced about 10 million cubic yards of material, sand, silt, and clay from a glacial plateau that was about 600 feet high. And the landslide traveled about 0.7 miles from the toe of the slope. And this is a remarkably long distance for a slide that occurred on such a sort of modest hill slope. And, of course, directly contributed to the loss of life and the destructiveness of it. The slide occurred in an area of known landsliding. Geologic maps of the area show landslides on both the north and south sides of the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River Valley. And landslide activity had been documented in the immediate vicinity of the SR 530 landslide going back to at least the 1950s. And that landslide activity, that older landslide activity known as the Hazel landslide, was most recently acted in 2006. When the landslide initially occurred and it blocked the river, the concerns were for the failure of that landslide dam to be rapid or catastrophic and to release a flood pulse. At this time, those concerns have abated, in part because the river has cut through those landslide sediments, but the sediment from that landslide will continue to impact areas downstream. The river has now found a path through those landslide deposits, and Snohomish County, along with experts from the state and federal agencies, including the USGS, are assessing the situation to minimize long-term threats downstream. So this photograph here is one that was provided by the governor's office, and it provides sort of a dramatic illustration of what we were talking about in terms of the runout of the landslide. The community of Steelhead Haven was located here, and you can see this sort of modest height, 600-foot-high glacial terrace, but the material ran out, again, almost a mile. The river's flowing left to right here. At this time, this figure was taken. You can see the impoundment that's upstream here, and then this is SR 530 here that's buried here. Right to left, I'm sorry. Thanks. Looks confused when I'm on the slide or off the slide. Rainfall likely contributed to the initiation of the landslide. The period from the end of February to the end of March was unusually wet. However, the winter season was drier than normal, and precipitation for the period October to March was about average. This map here just shows the precipitation average. This comes from the National Weather Service, NOAA Regional Climate Centers. And here's the rough location of the SR 530 landslide. And the purple colors indicate between 200 and 300% of precipitation over that period, so the end of February to the day of the landslide. However, there weren't instrumented wells in the landslide itself or in the vicinity of the landslide, and that prevents a quantitative assessment of groundwater levels in response to this rainfall. In March 2014, the flow in the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River was high, but it wasn't exceptional or record-breaking. And careful review of data from a nearby seismic station rules out an earthquake as a triggering mechanism for the slide. So at the request of Snohomish County and Washington State, the United States Geological Survey dispatched teams to assess the stability of the landslide dam and to monitor stream flow and the level of the lake impounded by the slide, as well as to examine the response of the river to the landslide and to assess the effect on flood hazards. Again, this work was done in support of the search operations, so again, to ensure the life safety of the search operations. Stream flow data collected at existing and newly installed stations are being used by the National Weather Service to evaluate the impact of rainfall on lake levels, as well as to revise models for potential flooding hazard downstream. The USGS used high-resolution LIDAR topography obtained by the Stillaguamish tribe prior to the slide in 2013, and in 2014 that was obtained by the Washington State Department of Transportation to estimate landslide deposit thicknesses. These results were used to guide search operations. Similarly, USGS ran some simulations of landslide motion that were also used to assist the search operations and increase their efficiency. USGS dispatched a second team to assess the potential for additional landslide activity, again, to support the search operations. These activities included the deployment of instruments developed for use on active volcanoes. These are the SPIDER instruments that you may have seen in the news out of the Cascade Volcano Observatory in Vancouver. And these instruments are used to detect ground movement with global positioning system, GPS technology, so we can detect movement down sub-centimeter or, you know, less than an inch, and detect vibrations with seismic instruments. And the idea with that would be that seismic activity or small seismic activity that would come from landslide motion would give you a precursory signal before the landslide, any additional landsliding occurred. This was part of a monitoring system that involved personnel and equipment from Washington Department of Transportation, the Department of Natural Resources, and Snohomish County. And that's just sort of the list there of the different aspects that we used for this monitoring activity. And key component of that was having trained personnel, you know, knowledgeable people on the ground just basically watching so that they could communicate with the heads of the search operation too, so to report any activity or any concerns that they might have. So that communications infrastructure actually turned out to be the critical component. When the active search was suspended, the USGS suspended its search operations as well. The landslide program and the landslide group in the USGS is quite small, and our resources are limited, so we defined our mission rather narrowly with respect to the slide. During that monitoring period, there were some small, sort of tens of cubic yards landslides that were observed both instrumentally and by observers. Mainly on the steep upper parts of the landslide, so up in this part here. None of these small slides impacted the search operations. So this is just a map showing, it's an aerial photograph of the landslide itself. Here's the river cutting through the landslide, and these are just different instrument locations. The blue dots are survey markers. The red lines are extensometers. These are cables that when the cable pulls longer, it gives you a reading of how much distance it moved. And the yellow triangles are the location of the USGS spiders. Those are still on site. They're scheduled to be removed by the end of the month when the disaster declaration ends. And I understand that two of them are not operating at this time. So examination of high-resolution topography, and Dave Norman mentioned this just a moment ago, how LIDAR topography is sort of revolutionized geology and landslide detection in the Pacific Northwest because of the vegetation. It gives you a look at the ground surface below the vegetation. And if we look at high-resolution LIDAR topography of the vicinity of the SR 530 landslide, and that's shown here as this red hasher. So that's the outline of the SR 530 landslide. If we look broadly in the valley, we see that there are other landslides that may have behaved similarly to the SR 530. When I say behave similarly, I mean run out far and fast in the past. So these other landslides, which are identified by colors here and letters, for instance, B here is in orange. This is relatively young compared to C and D. The slide about 1 mile downstream from the SR 530 landslide is somewhat bigger. It's not clear if it's one or two landslides, but nonetheless, the deposit is somewhat bigger, and it appears to behave similarly in that it ran out far and presumably fast. When that slide occurred is not known. It's not suspected it was in historical period, but how old it is, we don't know. So going forward, we have a number of hazard and research questions that I've listed here that should be addressed. And first and foremost amongst those is, why did the landslide, the SR 530 landslide, travel so far, and why was it so destructive? That's the key to that destructiveness. And are these conditions at the SR 530 slide unique? Or are they present elsewhere, not only in the North Fork of the Stillaguamish Valley, but elsewhere in the Puget Lowland? And along those lines, similarly, how old are the long-traveled landslides that we see in the LIDAR imagery, just like the one we saw there? And that's a critical question to answer in respect to risk. If you want to understand what risk these present, you need to know how frequent they are. And are they related to earthquake activity or not? We know that SR 530 wasn't related to earthquake activity, so it's not a necessary condition, but it might be sufficient. And where else in the area are similar landslide deposits located? That's along those same lines. And then with respect to the SR 530 landslide, what effect is that landslide going to have on the downstream flood hazard and ecology, particularly with sediment that is put into the river? What effect is that going to have on fish ecology in particular? That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Our next presenter is to discuss what's known scientific knowledge about groundwater recharge, and Bradley Biggerstaff. Thank you for being with us today.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Board, for allowing me to visit with you this morning. Mr. Norman and the others have presented information sort of on a larger scale than a lot of the projects that we work on. I'm a principal engineering geologist and hydrogeologist with a consulting company, GeoResources, and we, like many of the other consulting firms that do geotechnical work in the Puget Sound area, deal with landslides, often on a daily basis through the winter, from small scale to larger scale. We use a variety of sources to help us either assess the potential for landslides, assess the causes of landslides, or help with the repairs of folks that are able to do that. The primary tools that we use are mostly existing databases, many of which are provided by both the USGS, federal government, and state agencies like DNR. Those are essential to the work that we do. Topographic maps, as was mentioned, the LIDAR, aerial photography, both oblique, orthophotos, and a variety of others, and the historical databases that are provided are essential to the initial look that we have at an area when we're hired to go in and look at the potential. In addition to that, we use geologic publications, reports, maps, existing files or open files that are in progress if we have access to those. Again, this is at both the federal and state level, but also at the local levels, both county and in some cases city documents. Most of the local agencies, such as counties and cities, have on file geologic hazard map, many of which are based on both USGS and state level Department of Natural Resource data, but also implemented by the history that occurs within their own jurisdictions. We also use soils information, the National Resource Conservation Service, or what's commonly referred to as the SCS. In addition, particularly in areas where we are working in timber areas, we're talking to the local foresters and large landowners that may have databases that they use internally to provide both information for road construction, harvest, or historic landslide. And related to that historical information, we find that in addition to the larger landowners, the tribes, the contractors that work within these different large parcels provide information, and many of them have historical, sometimes anecdotal, that help us in doing an assessment of the potential for additional landslide activity. If we're lucky and there has been prehistoric or historic slope movement in the areas, we can also find geotechnical information from other companies that will help us assess the potential for future landslide activities. Many of this information is provided based on either previous activities at the sites or development that is either proposed or has occurred. We also look at the hydrogeologic information that is available. Many of that, again, is public. Water well records, rainfall data, as previously mentioned, monitoring data that is available through USGS, the tribes, fisheries. But the real important thing that we do once we've looked at the databases is to do the reconnaissance at the specific site. It's really hard to replace boots on the ground. And the last thing that has become something of significance in the last 30 years is computer modeling. As you're aware, there's a variety of programs for both groundwater modeling, slope stability modeling, and in the last 10 to 15 years, many of those programs have become joined or married and provide excellent resources for that assessment that we do. But the problem with modeling is that without good data to input into the model is challenging in itself. And again, this is why we like to see the sites, walk the sites, and take a look at that with as many other folks involved in the project as we can. And I would just like to say that Washington State is really unique in the available data that we have through the Department of Natural Resources. It's a great database. The new geologic portal that they have has helped significantly in the work that we do. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave and Jonathan and Bradley, if you'd stay, why don't we just bring you up to the center's table here and take some questions. Board Member Summers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Dave Norman, you had a slide about the systematic landslide hazard maps, and I didn't catch the coverage or how many parts of the, particularly the west side, we have covered with those specific maps.
Yeah, not a lot. There was think there was, if you totaled them all up, there was about 150 or so out of about 750-something. It's far from complete.
Are they time-consuming, expensive?
Yes.
Yes to both?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And I
do think that you could, by having better information in terms of LIDAR, though, in front of the geologists that would evaluate this, would speed this process up considerably and would probably be a cost savings. Even though you have an initial investment in purchasing the LIDAR, which could be high, it would speed things up and they'd be more accurate. Doing analyses with just air photos in with no LIDAR ends up meaning you miss about 70% of the landslides when you're looking at these because the air photos you just can't see through it. So
yeah, and they don't really stand out on the digital elevation model.
So I think you could do it faster and better.
Okay, for Jonathan, the one slide you showed, and we've looked at this time and time again. So the valley around the Oso slide and the LIDAR, it's so evident. The history in geologic time of past events. Do you have any idea that the large landslide B, that's labeled B, of the age of that?
No, presumably it's older than historical period, but younger than 15,000 years. So, no, we don't really have a good answer for that this time.
In this particular area of the river valley, you could look at all those slides and do some field work and verification to kind of get an age estimate of these and get us a rate, but that would take a specific study of this area.
That's correct, and there'd probably be carbon-14 dating that would be possible in those landslides, so you could potentially nail down those dates better.
Okay. And that's all for now. Thank you.
Board Member Sabine.
So I have a couple questions. One is, given the importance of LIDAR to be able to accurately detect these areas, how much would it cost and how quickly would it take to acquire comprehensive LIDAR coverage for at least the glaciated areas of the state?
Well, to do the rest of the state, probably about $20 million if you did the rest of Washington that wasn't in color that we were looking at. You would prioritize it. You wouldn't do it all at once necessarily. You would certainly do it in terms of a priority. I've started working on a map that would look at the priority for that. To start out with, there's probably what I consider four priority areas on the west side that is probably four or five million for those areas. But those are areas, the criteria for collecting LIDAR that you, that has the best information or data is that this is flowing in the right conditions and when leaves are off. And it's a very narrow window when that's done. So LIDAR that's done when leaves are on or that has, you know, bad weather or whatever it is, you end up with inferior data that doesn't become very useful. So it's something that you couldn't really collect all of the state all at once particularly well anyway. You'd want to stage it so that you get a priority for it.
And my second question has to do with, and this is for you, Bradley, and Aaron, if we have another presentation on this later, then we can defer it. But there hasn't been a lot of discussion yet on the interaction between forest cover and groundwater recharge in some of these areas. So is that a bigger topic later, or is it an open question?
Fine.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about the impact of removing some or all tree cover in areas that are groundwater recharge zones?
Sure. So typically, when we look at a site and we're looking at the forest cover, the canopy, we're also looking, as I was discussing, with the soil conditions, determining whether it is a recharge area. If you're harvesting in an area that's glacial till, the recharge is fairly limited in terms of deeper aquifers. But if you have a system where it's recessional soils or sands and gravels, basically, and you're getting the recharge, then you do have to assess the amount of timber that is being removed, and in some cases you want to limit the harvest. But, topography, the amount of timber that's being removed, the depth of the soil itself, and then if you know that you have existing groundwater tables in the area, all kind of come together to play to that. So as far as actual numbers, we use the Soil Conservation Survey, USGS data, to look at soil conditions. So is it all sand? Is it sand and gravel? And then the type of timber harvest or the timber canopy that you have and the age of it. And you determine what the change would be. And we use what's called a water budget to do that. And it really just depends on all the different variables that you're looking at in terms of what the actual percentage changes to recharge would be. I don't know if that's accurate enough to answer your question, but
it's good enough to start the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Follow up on LIDAR. And I'm aware we have a Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium that appears to be a set of agencies that contract for LIDAR imaging. What's the state's role in that? And is, you know, can we move forward the Dave, your estimate of, you know, $20 million for the state or four to five for four priority areas? Is that just looking at state forest lands and timberlands, or is that the whole west side four priorities on the west side?
No, it wasn't just forest lands. These were large areas that were not forested necessarily on the west side. So these would be in areas like Whatcom, Skagit County, Snohomish County, that are areas that don't have adequate LIDAR. Down into southwest Clark County and areas of that nature. It's not just forested. I would encourage the state to look at collecting LIDAR for multiple purposes, though, than just, say, forestry or for whatever the other purposes are, where they're flooding, land use planning, any number of uses for LIDAR that go far beyond just looking at forested lands for slope stability?
Obviously, the slide has pointed out that we're all neighbors, and you know, we have forested lands and state and private timberlands and residential, rural residential, that kind of thing, immediately adjacent. So mm-hmm. that, and it, you pointed out the early LIDAR in this area was done by the Stille tribe looking at Salmon River sorts of things. So the point I'm getting to is, does the state then share in costs with other agencies, or do you know how the consortium works and
I would encourage us all to look at how LIDAR is collected. It isn't a state managed program. It is something that's an ad hoc program through the Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium. But I believe that probably the proper way to do this would be to have some sort of state management of LIDAR collection and then serving the data out in a manageable way. I believe you would have cost savings, and you would also then create better partnerships through this that would allow the cost to go down. Because as you start to do this, if you get bigger blocks as you go to contract for this, you'll have a cost savings. The most expensive type of LIDAR is when you fly small areas. If you fly larger areas, you get a price break. And so you want to get that price break every time, and you want to share the costs with the other landowners for multiple purposes.
Okay. And I guess one last question for Bradley. You talked about models and needing good data on an area, whether it's the Oso slide or similar area. Is it an expensive thing to understand the geology there and the groundwater tables and how management activities might affect or influence what happens? Give me a sense of what we're talking about.
It basically depends on the area that you would be looking at. Obviously, the larger area, the more expensive it is. If you have water wells in the area, that helps, but a larger parcel that has forested conditions, you're likely to not have that type of data available. So it makes it a little bit more of a challenge. And you can do borings in those areas, but it's kind of a random thing. Where do you put the boring if you're going to do it? And, those can be fairly expensive. You could be talking, not millions of dollars, but certainly tens of thousands of dollars for individual borings, depending on how deep you're going to go. And then, you'd want to put a well in, and then you got to monitor it. So that makes it a cost-effective process if you know where you want to focus your efforts, but to sort of look at it from a shotgun approach and try and cover what we might consider as the potential areas, it becomes very expensive.
Okay, thank you.
Sticking with that, Bradley, one of the factors that affects groundwater movement, as I understand it, in glacial soils is the underlying layer of clay, lake sediment, formerly lake sediment. And our geologists who are performing site reviews making sort of inference that the surface topography mirrors the surface of the lake sediment for the purposes of understanding where the water's going underground, or how do you make those kinds of judgments?
Well, and a lot of it is, if you're working in environments where you have exposed soils, so slopes, that gives you a window into the underlying topography or stratigraphy, which then you can make assessments of whether you do have the clays that are underlying the sands and gravels, the classic recharge situation that results in slope instability. But a large area that is forested and has limited subsurface exposure in terms of steep slopes or something of that nature, it becomes more of an assessment of looking at the geologic data that's available, the maps, the soils information, and then trying to determine, again, when you're on the ground, are you seeing vegetation that would suggest that you have groundwater seepage that's making its way to the surface? And you use that information to try and, again, model as best you can. And but a lot of times it's kind of a hard guess to come up with that information.
Board Member Stanley.
Mr. Norman, just one thing interested me, that LIDAR is better when leaves are off, just because of accuracy. Since we live on the west side with coniferous forests, could it be done any time for the most part?
Well, you'll still get better data, even though you have, let's just say you do pick an area that is primarily coniferous. There's always going to be deciduous areas along the drainages and riparian zones and things like that that you'd want to pick up with better LIDAR. So you need to have enough laser strikes to the ground that would actually show something. So, yeah, data is poorer when you have a heavy, conifer forest, but you'll still want to do it with leaf off if that's possible.
Jonathan, you closed with a slide of research questions that USGS thinks are appropriate to pursue moving ahead. Does that constitute the sort of full scope of inquiry that the agency is involved with, or are there more questions that you're working on? Is there an investigation as to cause? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I would think that list right there is probably the list of questions that the federal government would play a role in. With respect to cause, that's a question that may not be answerable in a satisfactory way, because the slide has, in essence, done its thing. And so from an empirical standpoint, you can't recover those data. There's no way to put instruments in the ground prior to the landslide occurring. So you'd be relying on numerical models that were mentioned just a moment ago, which of course are based on assumptions. And so those assumptions are going to vary in each of those studies. And so there's always that level of uncertainty with those assumptions that go into those models.
Just to go back on that question, those were excellent questions. Is it fair to say there isn't actually a funded follow-up study, or to what degree would USGS be following up on some of these questions? And I'm aware that Snohomish County's USGS, DNR, everybody's been fantastic during the slide, and I just want to thank you all. But we know that these questions are out there, and looking forward, is there funding for answering some of these questions, or are you going to be looking at that? We can't assume that these questions are going to be answered.
That's correct. So right now there's a discussion amongst the state and the county and the USGS about seeking additional funding from FEMA through an interagency agreement, and those discussions are ongoing, and I'm not quite aware what the latest information is on that. Once that picture becomes clearer, then the USGS will be in a position to say what can be done absent those funds. I can't commit at this time personally to say that the USGS is going to continue work here, but I would very much like to see that happen.
I saw a very back of the envelope sketch of work related to some of these questions, and it was, absolutely ballparky, but it was several millions of dollars.
That's correct, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Member Sudeen.
So I just want to make sure I understand kind of a summary of some important points that came out from your presentations. This is mostly about other areas then also. So, one is that LIDAR is really important to be able to accurately identify where deep-seated landslides are. And we don't have it in a lot of areas. And then the second point is that trying to delineate the groundwater recharge areas associated with those landslides isn't always easy either. So given those two things, and I know there's going to be a lot of good discussion later about how DNR geologists in the context of Forest Practices Program, identify these hazard areas and all the steps they go through. But just given those two situations, kind of stepping back from a scientific perspective, is it safe to say then that it's possible to miss some of these areas? in sort of any context, it's possible to not know where glacial deep-seated landslides are, and it's possible to not have complete accuracy in your delineation of the groundwater recharge area. Or do you just use other tools? And the answer would be, you know, yeah, we can, when we get out on the ground, we can probably find these things.
Well, I can give you an example of a recent assessment that we did, and we actually did do subsurface explorations to identify where the potentially perching layers of the groundwater system were. And then that information was used in a model. And even though we had very limited groundwater, we were actually asked to go back and rerun the models by increasing the groundwater levels in the model by the DNR forest practices folks. So we sort of look at it from the standpoint that we can sort of push it to an extreme, if you will, and see, well, what would happen. And that is, of course, the benefit of having computer models.
So I think if you have accurate topography, which is what LIDAR is giving you, you're going to do a much better job. Are you going to be able to say 100% all of the time? I don't know if there's anything that's that way. But certainly having the more accurate topography for any number of decisions would be critical.
Board Member Starr.
I want to thank all three of you for the presentations. I want to go back to the five questions or the six questions that were there, Jonathan, in your presentation. If you had the several million dollars that it would take to do that research, how long would that take?
Yeah, that's a good question. Several years, probably, and part of the reason for the large cost that we were sketching out with FEMA was the need to hire additional people to do some of that work. So that increases the cost, obviously. Again, the USGS aspect, and I would say the state and the county are in similar situations. There just are a limited number of experts. The expertise is pretty limited in these areas. And I can go into some detail about the program if you want that, but I don't think that's probably necessary.
That's fine. Thank you.
Any further? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Our next panel leads with Stephen Bernath, who is the water quality lead at Department of Ecology on forest and fish issues. He's going to give us some context, having been a participant in forest and fish report negotiations and specifically around the unstable slopes rural group development. So thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Chair, board members, staff, and publics. I'm Stephen Bernath. I'm the forest policy lead for the Department of Ecology. And I just, as Aaron mentioned, I worked for DNR from 88 to 2000 and participated both as a forest hydrologist, the lead for watershed analysis, and the policy person when negotiating forest and fish report. Just for full disclosure, some of the information I used to put this presentation together included the 76 rule book, the 82 rule book, the current rules, the CEMER work plan, the TFW report, and the forest and fish report. So what I'd like to do, I could have the next slide, please.
In advance at yourself on the mouse, sir.
Okay, gotcha. Working. There we go. Okay. Three different things. All right. So I'd like to take you quickly through the history of the unstable slopes rules, how watershed analysis played into that, the forest and fish commitments under unstable slopes, and what resulted from that as far as the forest and fish rules. So history of the unstable slope rules and forest practices, there were no rules pre-1982. However, there was broad conditioning authority from the beginning of the Forest Practices Act when the 76 rules were adopted that asked gave DNR the authority to protect or make sure that potential or actual material damage to public resources was always there. And that basically means to define public resources, you can protect fish, water, wildlife, and capital improvements of the state. In 1982, when that rule package was passed, it established the first class four special trigger for roads. So roads on excessively steep slopes or slide-prone areas. And these citations on this particular slide are from the 82 rule books. They don't match up with any citations you would have at this point in time. So you'd have your first class four special trigger regarding roads, and then there was a specific quote in the road rules about not locating roads on excessively steep or unstable slopes or known slide-prone areas. One of the things, landslides, as the three gentlemen before me pointed out, landslides are a natural feature of this state. There was some large storms in the early 80s up in the northwest part of this region, something that became very clear to folks who were negotiating the TFW agreement is you could have things occur, particularly during rain on snow events or other large events, where culverts would get plugged. You know, a large, shallow, rapid landslide would occur, and then it could run out quite a ways. And so the 83 flood concerned people because at the bottom of the hill, somebody had built a barn, and that property was destroyed. So what I'm trying to start here is build you a picture of how we eventually got to public safety. So in that case, what we had conditioning authority to protect public resources, but not for public safety. During the TFW agreement, it was really clear that people wanted to invest more in technical expertise with the department, have better information and maps, identify where the rain on snow zones were that sometimes trigger some of these events, and do some monitoring. An affirmation in the TFW agreement was to support DNR's broad conditioning authority to make harvest on slide prone areas a class three priority issues, which required ID teams. Now, back before there was a harvest on unstable slopes class four trigger, class three priorities was things that required you to go out in an interdisciplinary team and look at sites and determine what was best for that site so that DNR could condition that application to protect public resources. In 1988, showing that they wanted to continue to staff up on these particular kinds of expertise, we hired our first regulatory geologist. And that person was fully employed because many of the harvests or forest practices that ID teams were called on were around unstable slopes areas.
Just as your, if you can go back to that slide for a second, Stephen, I want to do just a little bit of acronym patrol for folks
who
might not be familiar. So TFW refers to?
The Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Agreement.
Significant because?
Because that's when the Environmental Caucus, the state resource agencies, the forest landowners, and
tribes.
Thank you, Dave. One of the few people around that were there came together and agreed on how forest practices were going to move forward, include both statutory and new rules that occurred as a result of that agreement.
Gotcha. And conditioning refers to?
Conditioning is the activity that DNR has the authority to do when they review a forest practice application. DNR has the opportunity on a site-specific basis to actually condition an application to protect public resources.
And interdisciplinary teams are typically comprised of?
The specialists that are needed for that activity. So if you have an ESA issue, then you're probably going to have fish or wildlife biologists. If you have an unstable slopes activity, you're going to have a geologist, et cetera.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right. We also hired a soil scientist in 1990, again, staffing up. So at that point, we had a hydrologist, a geologist, and a soil scientist all working occasionally, sometimes on unstable slopes. And in 1990, the work from the TFW agreement and some lawsuits that were out there at the time resulted in additional emergency rules. And at that time, we started with a rain on snow rule and the harvesting, forced timber harvesting on unstable slopes became a class 4 special for the first time. At that time, there was no specific SEPA guidance around unstable slopes. It was just broad SEPA guidance that was, according to what it was referred to the ecology rules on SEPA. 1992, those rules became permanent, which was an outcome of the Sustainable Forestry Roundtable, and 1990 legislation that basically the partners in the Sustainable Forestry Roundtable went to the legislature. The legislature said, you don't really need statutory authority to do this, board. Adopt these rules and we'll give you money to implement them. And that's what they did. Part of that permanent rule was establishing watershed analysis, which was a cause and effect of analysis that looked at what are the sensitive features in a particular watershed and how should future forest practices be prescribed there to avoid issues such as water quality, sediment, et cetera. Any questions on that?
Actually, right. I do have a quick question.
Yes.
What was it that got the board to consider an emergency rule in 1990?
At that time, there was a lawsuit that, and I'm not going to be able to talk about specifics, but it was a Snohomish County case around Lake Rosinger, and it resulted, I believe, and some of the rules either being incomplete or invalid. And so the board had to take action, and these were two of the rules that they took action on.
It revolved around cumulative effects in forestry, and there wasn't really a process, and watershed analysis was put forward as a process. Totally
right.
Over time in a watershed.
Thank you. I knew somebody would keep me on straight. Okay. Let me make sure I'm on the right. So as a result of the 92 rule package being adopted, the legislature gave us some DNR at the time money to implement that rule package, and we went from having 3 specialists on the DNR science team to 10. We are able to hire individual scientists for each of the DNR 7 regions at the time to support watershed analysis, to support more local work as needed on interdisciplinary teams, and at times to work as a team on watershed analyses. There's a particular water, it was referred to in a previous presentation by Dave Norman. Watershed analysis, one of the modules in watershed analysis required a qualified geologist to go out and map what we called mass wasting map units. And at first, the first watershed analyses, they were very general, broad, painted geographies that basically said, if you're going to plan on harvesting in this large area, have a geologist come out and do a site-specific analysis. Well, over time, the watershed analysis process got much more sophisticated, and the delineation was much more what we would consider, specific mapping of specific features, and the prescriptions became much more specific. And as a result of that, some of the delineations, the broad delineations, went away when we updated the watershed analysis rules when you voted to do that a few years ago. Most of the watershed analysis resulted in four kinds of unstable slopes being identified. And I'll just leave that at for a moment and come back to it. So, if you'll recall, Forest and Fish came about in the mid-90s. In 96, the fall of 96, there was a commitment by the board to move forward on the negotiations of the Forest and Fish Agreement because of our need to protect fish all the way to the extent of their in their stream systems, to do better on identifying unstable slopes, to do better on roads, and to have wider riparian zones. The commitments around the Forest and Fish Report were codified in House Bill 2091 in 1999 legislative session. And these are the commitments specific to unstable slopes. There was a commitment to screen each application for risks associated with unstable slopes. There were screening tools that were to be developed and put together. One was a model for identifying shallow rapid landslides. Another, as Dave Norman showed you, there was a deep-seated landslide inventory developed. It was just putting all the mapping together that existed. It didn't involve new identification. It was just of existing slides. There was a commitment to purchase the 10-meter DEM model statewide to assist with a shallow rapid landslide model and also water typing. And then there was a commitment to move forward on hazard zonation mapping, which Dave Norman also recommended. Unfortunately, that process wasn't completed because of budget cuts. The other thing that was committed to is that every time there was a potential for a forest practice on an unstable landform, a DNR forester had to go out and verify that it was present and had the potential to deliver. In addition, as a result of that, foresters had to be trained, and that training took place. DNR and others were trained. The four unstable slope categories that were recognized were intergorges, convergent headwalls, and bedlock hollers, steeper than 70%. That's one category. Toes of deep-seated landslides with slopes greater than 65%. Groundwater recharge areas for glacier deep-seated landslides. And the outer edge of meanders of unconfined meandering streams, or CMZs. And then we had a catch-all category, which if you had a number of indicators, you could go out and still trigger a Class 4 special. This is the common things we kept finding in each of the watershed analyses, and that's why we pulled them out of watershed analysis and put them in the rule for forest and fish. We also made a commitment to look at whether there were other regional landforms that might be unique to certain regions of the state and see if there was something else that should be included. Landowners were required to show unstable landforms on FPAs. Landowners were also encouraged to voluntarily provide a geology report on risks up front. And where potentially unstable slope has the potential to deliver sediment or debris to a public resource or threaten public safety. So this is where we decided to include threat and public safety because there have been a number of things occurring over the years, whether it was the 83 flood situation where property and people were hurt, to DOT coming to us and saying, hey, you know, when you're doing harvesting on near snow avalanche slopes, we want to know about it, and we want to make sure that, you know, highways and peoples are protected. And then we physically, sometimes we would have forced practices on a steep hillside, no water or anything determined as public resources below, but you'd have a development sitting on an alluvial fan or something. And so we would, our tool at that point would be to encourage the landowner to think about what they were doing. Specific SEPA guidance, that was always also a commitment to do that. We had done that first in the mid-90s with ESA species, and we thought that was a good model to continue. So we provided agreed to some specific, so asked that a geology report be written, that what are the forest practices proposed on the potentially unstable slopes? Is it likely to increase potential for failure? If the slope fail, had the potential to deliver to a public resource or threaten public safety? And what was the proposed mitigation if any of those questions were yes? In addition, they had to do a SEPA checklist. We also made a commitment to develop the board manual for use by qualified experts in making SEPA assessments with respect to the potentially unstable slopes. And I want to spend just a minute on this slide. The SEPA guidance was meant to provide assistance to DNR on how to review a completed proposal with the goal of keeping mass wasting that delivers to public resources or threatens public safety at near natural rates and make the required threshold determination that's read out of the Forest and Fish report. This results in DNR reviewing an application with a qualified expert and determining whether the proposed forest practice is likely to increase the probability of failure that would deliver increase the probability of failure that would deliver, then it is likely to cause significant adverse impacts. That's important language to DNR as guidance because it determines when the responsible official who does SEPA or environmental review, the state environmental policy review, it guides them when something is likely to cause a significant adverse impact. So that's important language. So finally, that was all the commitments we made in FFR, and it resulted in the Class 4 special rule being refined to specific landforms and also including snow avalanche slopes. We added the SEPA guidance. The shallow rapid landslide screen was completed. The deep-seated inventory was completed based on known mapping to date. The hazard zonation mapping began but wasn't committed. It's still need some work, as indicated by other speakers this morning. We defined all these, what is now known as rule identified landforms in the definitions chapter. The Forest Practice Board Manual number 16 was adopted. Regional features were explored, but there were no rule proposals to you as a board because they felt they could be all be caught under the catch-all category. And training occurred for not just DNR foresters, but other foresters that might be dealing with unstable slopes, such as landowner foresters. And qualified experts were defined. So again, this is the last slide. What are our performance targets in all of this? If you go to Schedule L1, which is basically the thing that both the Forest Fish Policy Group and CEMER, the Cooperative Monitoring Evaluation Research Group, looks to in figuring out what our research strategies should be. Schedule L1, particularly for harvest on unstable sources, no increase in sediment over natural background rates is the target. And there's a broader statement contained in the current CEMER work plan to prevent forest practices from increasing or accelerating mass wasting beyond natural occurring rates. So that's sort of the historic perspective. Let me ask if there are any questions.
We'll do just as we did before and have a panel and do questions at the end. So Mark Engel, would you please join us and walk through the current rule and board manual requirements around unstable slopes?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Mark Engel. I'm an assistant division manager with Forest Practices Division. I'm going to briefly go through the unstable slopes, landform rules, and board manual guidance. So a lot of the workshop today is you're kind of, from now on, we're going to be building kind of foundation from which the board can understand the history of the rules and how we currently review and process forest practices applications. You have heard a brief history from Stephen Bernath, and so now we'll cover what's the current rules in the forest practice rules. The authors of the Forest and Fish Report, who included the federal, state agencies, tribes, county representatives, and private landowners, recognized the need to prevent or avoid an increase or acceleration of naturally occurring rate of landslides due to forest practice activities. Their recommendations to adopt rules and approve guidance to address risks to aquatic resources and threats to public safety were contained in Appendix C of the Forest and Fish Report. As you've just heard, the legislature passed 2091, which incorporated the findings of the Forest and Fish Report into state law primarily in 7785 of the statutes, but they directed the Forest Practices Board in 7609055 to adopt Forest and Fish recommendations into the rules. So the goal is to protect public resources and prevent threats to public safety. Protection is provided through an outcome-based decision-making process that is conducted in accordance with the two forest practices rules. The first, the Class 4 Special Rule, which describes the practices and landforms subject to SEPA analysis, and a SEPA Policies Rule for potentially unstable slopes and landforms. If a forest practice is proposing specifically potential unstable slopes and landforms, and there is a potential to deliver sediment or debris to a public resource, or has the potential to threaten public safety, the following forest practices are subject to Class 4 Special Classification and SEPA analysis: timber harvest or construction of roads, landings, gravel pits, rock quarries, spoil disposal areas. Again, as is previously mentioned out of the Forest and Fish Report, there were potential unstable slopes and landforms that were recognized. For the rest of today and part of tomorrow, you'll probably hear a lot about RILs, which are rural identified landforms. Here I'm going to take them with letters. So the first group, as you just saw in the last presentation, where the inner gorges converge at headwalls, bedrock hollows steeper than 35 degrees or 75%, toes of deep-seated landslides steeper than 65%, groundwater recharge areas for glacial deep-seated landslides, the outer edges of meander beds along valley walls or high terraces of an unconfined meandering stream, and any areas containing features indicating the presence of potential slope instability, which cumulatively indicate the presence of unstable slopes. These are the any unstable, potentially unstable features that are found within forest practices areas. As was also just mentioned in the last presentation, there was a regional landslide inventory project which was completed. What was found is that in many geographic areas of the state there are types of features that are potentially unstable slopes, but they're captured in E, category E. You'll probably hear that, or not probably, you will hear that throughout, as a common theme throughout the rest of the presentations when we address how we look for unstable features. Class 4 special rule. So the department will base its classification of the forest practice application on professional knowledge of the area, information such as soils, geologic hazards, zonation maps, reports, review of approved watershed analysis, master listing prescriptions, and other information provided by the applicant. Forest practice will not be subject to a class for special classification if the proposed forest practice would be in accordance with approved specific watershed analysis prescriptions, mass wasting prescriptions. So SEPA. The following policy is applied when forest practice proposed for construction or harvest on potentially unstable slopes or landforms. This is a requirement of both the landowner and DNR. Landowners are required to determine whether forest practices are likely to have a probable significant adverse impact. The applicant must submit the following information prepared by a qualified expert. What is the likelihood it would cause movement? The likelihood it would cause delivery of sediment or debris to a public resource or threaten public safety, and possible mitigation for the identified hazards or risks. DNR's role, once we receive this report, and these reports are called geotechnical reports, DNR then reviews, then makes a threshold determination after an evaluation, whether the proposed forest practices are likely to increase the probability of mass movement on or near the site, would deliver sediment or debris to a public resource, or in a manner that would threaten public safety, determine whether such movement and delivery are likely to cause significant adverse impacts. If any of these are found to occur, then we'll find a DS, decision of significance, determination of significance, and it would be an EIS. DNR will evaluate the proposal using appropriate expertise and in consultation with other affected agencies and Indian tribes. And specific mitigation measures or conditions must be designed to avoid accelerating rates and magnitudes of mass wasting that could deliver sediment or debris to a public resource or in a manner that would threaten public safety. We have talked earlier about qualified experts, those that are qualified to prepare the geotechnical report. They are licensed under Chapter 18220 of RCW as either a licensed engineering geologist or a hydrogeologist with 3 years' experience. Board Manual Section 16. So the board did approve a board manual to accompany the rules. It is, again, Board Manual 2015. It starts with an overview of the significance and the need for review of potentially unstable slopes and landforms. Explains how to measure slopes and angles. As you recall, when it described the landforms, there were specific angles associated with these features to make them an unstable feature. And it stopped working. I'll try pushing back. That didn't work. It's going the other way.
Backwards.
There we go. Describes the differences in slope form. So, and I actually pulled out part of the manual pages. Talks about planar slopes, convergent slopes, divergent slopes, so that you have an understanding of what you're looking at on the ground. And it describes the potentially unstable landforms and processes. It also gives a lot of indicators of from topographic and hydraulic features, hydrologic features to look at in the field, such as in earlier photos you saw the presence of bare rock, exposed soils, hummocky or bench surfaces, cracks in the surface, jackstraw or pistol-butted trees, et cetera. It gives quite a list. The Forest Practices Unstable Slopes Training actually follows the board manual in process and gives individuals both a classroom teaching as well as in the field look at unstable slopes and landforms. Thank you. And it provides detailed guidance for the qualified experts to complete geotechnical parts. It goes into quite detail over what is expected in every geotechnical report, and it actually gives guidance as to how to write the report in order to meet the requirements in the rule and allow us to make a complete evaluation.
Thanks, Mark. Maybe before we move on to the Mass Wasting Effectiveness Monitoring Project, we bring Stephen back up and do questions around the current rule requirements, and then we'll bring the authors up. Board Member Laurie.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentations. Mark, you spent a bunch of time talking about Class 4 specials. How many of those do we see normally?
We just pulled the number.
Well, approximately would be fine.
Between 75 and 100 each year.
Out of how many apps?
6,100. Last year.
So as I understand it, a lot of times private landowner will try to avoid these areas. So it seems to me that the question is, well, the terminology I saw was bounding out, try to not include unstable slopes areas in an application. So that kind of brings up the question is how do we have adequate information to know whether we're bounding out unstable landforms, including recharge areas? How does that determination happen?
Forest practice foresters use all of the screening tools available to us. We're going to have a detailed presentation over many of those tools and how forest practice apps are actually processed both in the office as well as in the field. Forest practice foresters do go out and walk the site when they see indicators in or around. They will contact our forest practices science team, which are the geologists. They do have the ability to call for ID teams. As recently as this last Friday, we've also asked for an additional form to be filled out by landowners to accompany the forest practice application to help give us additional information from which to screen the application both in the office and on the ground. there's a lot of effort made to walk all the areas in and around the app, which could be either affect the application or be affected by the application.
Board Member Summers.
This is probably for Steve, but in the watershed analysis process, there was an option or ability to go to a level two analysis, a higher scrutiny of an area. And I know there were, in the Yoso area, there was a level two study done. But what happens to that information that was done? It actually did some of the modeling we heard about a little bit earlier. But what happens? Does that get carried forward in current forest practices? Is it considered, or is it...
All of the original watershed analysis, approved watershed analysis, remain intact. However, most of the mass wasting prescriptions have been rescinded because the landowners have chose to go under the current forest practices rules. And I believe that the Hazel watershed analysis mass wasting prescriptions have been rescinded. However, all of the information contained within the mass wasting prescriptions remain as screening tools to assist in the review of any forest practices within the area.
And I believe one of the first phases of the landslide hazard zonation project that I referred to in my presentation and Dave Norman referred to was taking all the mass wasting map units from all the watershed analysis and making sure that those were contained in that inventory so that people could use it as a screen.
Yeah, that's correct. All of them remain as screening tools, so they're all still available.
And the hazard zonation, those are the same maps I asked about earlier in terms of how much coverage there was.
Correct. And at least during the forest and fish negotiations, there was never any sense that we would do hazard zonation on the whole state. The focus was on about one, as Dave Norman said, there would be a prioritization where about a third of the wilds in the state would be focused on specifically for unstable slopes mapping.
Okay, and just one follow-up, and I'm sorry I had to step out for a county council meeting decision just briefly, but is there, through the SEPA process now or through the permitting process, a trigger for the types of site-specific types of models or things that, like we had with Level 2, the Hazel analysis or that sort of thing? Do we ever get to that point, or is it not quite that specific?
Not aware of any triggers. All of the information that was generated during the original analysis still remains available for reference material. What happens now is that landowners have to follow the process as I've just outlined. It would be a Class 4 special. There would be a requirement for a technical report to be prepared by a qualified expert.
Thank you.
And maybe more directly, the glacial deep sea landslides, as you know, is an existing Class 4 special trigger. That was the question.
Yeah. It was more at the level of analysis, but I answered my own question.
Board Member Sweeney.
So you said there was somewhere between 75 and 100 of these that go to Class 4 special. Of those, how many are, you know, how many stop there because the analysis is successfully able to identify the unstable landform and essentially the forest practice proceeds without harvest in those area, or how many of those continue on and say get a determination of significance and then a landowner proceeds to additional analysis after that?
I do not know that answer. We'll have to find that out. So,
but is it common that once it goes to a Class 4 trigger that analysis is done and things just kind of stop there, or is it common that several of them would continue on to the next level of analysis?
Asking how many determinations of significance or non-significance, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
I'd be able to get that.
The vast majority are determinations of non-significance, or I don't know what the number would be of mitigated determinations of significance, MDNS.
Mm-hmm.
But the determination as a result of the SEPA process is combined with the standard review under the forest practice application. They go in parallel, and the board will actually hear that presentation later today on how we process the apps. But a tremendous amount of information is generated during a class four review of a class four special application, of which the determination made by the responsible official is included.
For Stephen, the current system of classing and landforms identified by class as far as the applications themselves, is my recollection is that the Appendix C of Forest and Fish Report is pretty explicit about that. Is that?
Yes, it's very explicit. Yeah, I took most of my slides right out of the Forest and Fish Report, Appendix C.
Okay, and so when it comes to the statutory underpinnings of the current rule set, That's where it originates. Is do you have a sense of the discussion that happened around setting the system up that way, perhaps in contrast to the way we have riparian buffers set up in terms of application classing as compared with a fixed width buffer or a desired future condition sort of a buffer? Do you have a recollection of why things were structured that way?
Well, I think the discussion would have been around each landslide can be a unique challenge, and so you have to do the geologic work to determine what's best for that site. We did have a discussion about whether to have actually no activities on unstable slopes, so an out-and-out moratorium on activities on unstable slopes, and we did not reach consensus in the forest and fish negotiations on that, and went the SEPA route instead.
Board Member Stanley.
So what level of training do you require on forest practice foresters for mass wasting?
All the forest practice foresters have to attend the DNR's unstable slopes training.
Often?
Often?
Or once every 5 years or 10 years?
We offer the training twice a year, in the spring and in the fall. The goal is to allow every field practitioner the opportunity to receive the training.
Gentlemen? This next presentation, I think board members are already somewhat familiar with. It's our Mass Wasting Effectiveness Monitoring Project. This is on the agenda as the most recent piece of adaptive management work and science development around landslide hazards. We're joined by the study authors and our adaptive management program administrator. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to provide a segue between what Mark Engel just talked about, the rules and board guidance, into the report itself. If you recall, the board created the Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research Committee, or what we call CEMER, and one of its purposes is to determine whether or not the rules that you just heard about are effective or not. And if not, then the board would have an opportunity to consider revising the rules. CEMER has a work plan that has over 90 projects in it. Those projects are subdivided by rule group. So, for example, the type N, type non-fish water rule group, the type F, or fish water group, and among the others, mass wasting rule group. And the project that you're going to hear about, or the report based on a project you're going to hear about today, is associated with a mass wasting rural group. So that said, I'll leave it to the authors.
Morning.
Morning. Thanks for having us. I want to start by acknowledging our co-authors who couldn't be here. Julie Dew was instrumental in developing, implementing, and completing this study. Jeff Phillips, again, he was instrumental in implementing and helping us complete that. And Matt O'Connor oversaw all the field work in this study. So this study was developed by the Upslope Scientific Advisory Group. It was a subgroup of CMER, and it was developed in 2005 and 2006. This is prior to any big storm. And the goal was to evaluate the effectiveness of the unstable slopes rules. And it was just going through review by the independent science review panel when the storm happened. And so that was moved through quickly, and the study was implemented the following summer. And the objectives were, again, to evaluate whether we were meeting the performance target for unstable slopes, which is no acceleration over background rates. And then the other was to see if we could identify any site-specific or prescription scale factors that were obvious on the landscape. And this really turned into, are there any smoking guns that, you know, somebody goes out there and it's obvious that there's a pipe leading to an area that failed, or something we should have obviously rectified. So this is a comparative landslide study. We do a comparative analysis between areas that were managed differently. And we don't look at what was intended to be done, we look at what was on the ground. So we had people go out, parse up the landscape into bins based on sort of management activities, and then compared landslide rates in those different areas. And a key requirement for this sort of comparative analysis is that you have a population of landslides to do the comparisons. Comparing zero against zero, you know, if I go outside and look in the parking lot, there's no landslides, I'm not going to find any differences. So we had to have a pretty good population of landslides in order to do that. And again, we didn't look at the FPA classification, geotech reports. We didn't try to figure out why things were they were the way they were, just what was on the ground. So most of you probably remember, and most people are familiar with the 2007 storm in terms of the flooding in the Chehalis Valley. But there was a large number of landslides also associated with it. You've seen some pictures from that. And DNR went up and did some aerial reconnaissance, and that's what the red dots are on this slide. And based on their aerial reconnaissance, we decided there were probably enough landslides to initiate this study. And so air photos were collected over a large area, and we did a randomized selection of study areas, study blocks. And our requirement was that based on the air photos, which are conservative, you don't see all the landslides, but if we saw at least one landslide per square mile, we would incorporate that block into our study. So this shows you actually our study blocks, which I'm going to get to in a second, but an important thing is that there were a range of rainfall intensities. So you've already heard that rainfall is an important driver of landsliding. And we had areas that received a large amount of rainfall. We had landslide densities of 30 to almost 40 landslides per square mile in the heart of the storm, the red areas. But we also had areas on the periphery that, you know, received maybe 4 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour period. That's a typical big winter storm. It's not huge by any means. And we had a range of rain landslide densities that went along with that. So what you see in this graphic is that the places that received a lot of rainfall had the most landslides, but we have a range of precipitation intensities and a range of landslide response across the study. And these blocks are where we collected our data. So you might wonder why we collected data in those little squares. And the big reason is that there are a lot of factors that drive landsliding. And this is a retrospective study. So you go out there after something has already happened and you want to make your comparisons. And it's important to account for the different factors that are driving landslide occurrence. A key one is precipitation. So we need to make sure that if we do comparisons between different types of forests or different management activities, that they all receive the same amount of precipitation. and they have similar slopes, and they have similar other, you know, management histories. And so what we do is we have a block, and we make comparisons within the block. And so within the block, we assume that everything received similar precipitation intensities. We account for slope using a covariate. And then that allows us to sort of get at what is the management or vegetation effect. Without having to do all the fancy math, we just do some simple comparative analyses. So this shows our randomly selected blocks. Again, these each had at least one landslide per square mile. And within each block, we went out and categorized the landscape into different management types. And I'll get to those in a second. But we had, you know, some mature forest. We had clear cuts, young. We had units that had been buffered. And then what we do is we make the comparisons within a block, and then we average the differences across blocks, and that gets us to our end result. One thing about this study is that this is a field-based effort, so you've heard that it's hard to identify all the landslides on air photos, and we don't have LIDAR for this part of the landscape. So we went out and did a field survey to identify all the landslides that delivered to a public resource. Our goal was not to look at the impact or the actual delivery. Our goal was to make sure that we got a census. All the landslides counted. We didn't miss any. We were pretty sure that, you know, driving around the roads, it's pretty obvious the landslides that delivered there. By hiking the streams, we could make sure we got all the landslides that delivered to a stream, and we're pretty sure we got everything that delivered to a public resource within the study blocks. There were a lot of landslides that we missed. Big landslides tend to stand out. People see them. If we saw a big landslide, we'd, you know, mark it, include it in our analysis. But there are a lot of landslides that we just wouldn't have counted because we didn't go to the entire landscape. We just really went to the streams and the roads and found everything that intersected them. So the landslide inventory, we inventoried 91 square miles of managed forest and about 555 miles of road. We counted about 940 landslides that delivered. We also had some that didn't, that we just ran into. And we had about 200 landslides that delivered to roads, and a number of other ones that didn't, that we also inventoried. An important thing is that most of these landslides, the great majority, are shallow rapid landslides. So when I talk about our data, I'm really talking about a shallow, rapid landslide response. This area is south of glaciation, so there are no deep-seated glacial landslides. We had a small number of deep-seated landslides. They had rotation depths that were beyond the rooting depth, so pretty deep rotational failures. But it's not associated with glaciation at all. So we had five harvest treatments, and these are historic treatments, effectively. This is not an experimental study. It was observational. And we broke up the harvest treatments by the age of the stands. So we had mature stands. They acted as a surrogate for background, sort of what we would expect to be the most stable. We had submature stands, and then we had three categories of young stands, less than 20 years old. Full buffer, which we expected to be most stable. That's basically what we require now under the current forest rules. Partial buffer, which I'll talk about, and then no buffer, which is effectively a clear cut. When we talk about the buffering here, we're talking about the rule-identified landforms that you've heard. And really, for this part of the landscape, we're talking about that Category A. So this is straight out of the board manual. We're talking about bedrock hollows, convergent headwalls, and inner gorges, and things that are pretty steep, above 70 degrees. And this is what a fully buffered unit might look like. So those trees up there are in a bedrock hollow. Okay, so they've been left there. They're not going to harvest the bedrock hollow, but they've harvested all around it. And so we would consider this a fully buffered unit. There were parts of the landscape where we saw that not all the rule-identified landforms appeared to have been buffered. maybe most of them were, but some had been cut. So this is an example. The areas in red are when our field crews went out, they walked up there, said this is should be a rural identified landform. It was harvested, and so we categorized that as partial buffering. Some of the rural identified landforms were buffered, but not all of them. Okay. And this is historic forest practices, the clear cut. So none of those unstable slopes are buffered, and we had these in our study. We also have submature stands. Again, these were probably clear cut 20 years before the storm, or 20 to 40 years before the storm. And this is all managed forest pretty much. So our mature stands, they get to 40 to 60, and then they're typically harvested. We're not looking at an old growth condition in this study. And here's our main result. What you see on the bottom there in the, I don't know if there's a laser pointer. Is there? This one. Okay. What you see at the bottom of this is the X bars, those are the mean landslide rates in the different categories. The bars there are error bars, 90% confidence intervals. You see that the confidence intervals are pretty wide. And the number or the letters at the top indicate significant differences based on an alpha of 0.1. And so things with different letters at the top are statistically different, meaning that it's unlikely the differences were observed just by random chance. And what you see is the mature has a C. The full buffer has a B and a C, which means it's not statistically different. You might observe that big a difference based on random chance. But, for example, the partial buffer has an A. It's statistically different. Same thing with the no buffer. Those are both statistically different than mature. Now, there's a problem with this analysis as laid out. The assumption, and so this was a mixed model, ANCOVA. It was a pretty fancy statistical model. But the assumption is that we account for all the factors that are affecting landsliding. So we accounted for precipitation through the blocking. We accounted for topography. We incorporated it as a covariate. But when we looked at the results, one of the things you see there is that the partial buffer is higher than no buffer. And you might wonder why leaving some trees on the landscape actually gets you a worse result. And it doesn't. One of the things we were expecting to see is that there would be a mingling of the ages of these different 0 to 20 groups, right? It's 0 to 20. But it turned out that the full buffer units were typically pretty young. The partial buffer units, maybe it was an intermediate period where people were still learning the rules, or they were going out, and maybe they were buffering some but not all. And then we get into the no buffer unit. And so I'm going to focus here on these three 0 to 20 groups. And I'm going to pull up a little bit of a complicated graph. This is data from three different studies. The one on the bottom is our study, the one I was just showing you. The one at the top, so again, this study, our study, was developed in 2006 and 2007. This is the one at the top is a paper that came out in 2008. And the one in the middle is a study by Weyerhaeuser that came out in 2010. And I just have highlighted that 0 to 20 group. And if you look at the top graph, what you see is that the landslide rates in the first, and this is for clear cuts, both the middle and the top are just looking at the clear cut portion of the landscape. And what you see is that in the first 5 to 10 years, or 1 to 10 years after harvest, you get a lot more landslides. And that's because root strength has declined. We're talking about shallow rapid landslides. Okay, root strength is an important thing. And we've also changed the hydrology. Typically, you get more runoff, less evapotranspiration of the water, and so wetter soils, and you get more landslides in that first 10 years. And both the study from Japan, 2008, and the Weyerhaeuser study show that same pattern. In our study, we incorporated the buffers into our units. And one thing that we see is that the full buffer unit there, the one on the left at the bottom, the youngest one, has less landslides than we would expect for a stand of that age. Okay, partial buffer actually is a little more than we might expect, but everything else pretty matches pretty well. And it's sort of based on this line of evidence that we said, you know, our results are consistent with the hypothesis that avoidance of clear-cut harvest on unstable terrain reduces the density and volume of landslides. The statistical analysis has a little bit of a problem with that because we don't account for the stand age effect. Okay. And this is also one reason that we think that it may be hard to meet the performance target for no increase over background if, in fact, the clear-cut portions of the landscape are always going to have more landslides. That part of the landscape, now, they may not all deliver, but that's an issue. The roads, the statistical analysis on the roads was largely inconclusive. And one of the reasons is, if you look at this map, really only four of our blocks, these ones in the core of the storm, had a large number of landslides. In other words, the roads held up pretty well for most rainfall intensities. But when you got into the core of the storm, we got a lot of landslides there. But when we try to do comparisons in these blocks here that have zero, I have five treatment groups, different types of roads. They all have zero landslides. There's no difference. And that confounded our results at the end. Ultimately, it was an overriding factor. The one thing that did come out with regard to roads was that formal road abandonment did appear to be effective, and not surprising. That's where you take out the entire roadbed, recontour the hill, and there's not sediment there to go downstream. And that, even with a few landslides, that was evident in our data. We had a couple other notable findings. About 40% of the landslides in our study did not originate from things that are considered rule-identified landforms. And that was a surprising number. Now, some of those could be Category E. Somebody may have gone out there and, you know, would have identified it as an unstable landform, but maybe not. The other thing that this was a good, so that was kind of on the unexpected, maybe not good end. On the good side, the field crews that went out there looking for those smoking guns didn't find a lot. In fact, we found very few obvious factors that were driving, you know, where people obviously did something really bad that just wasn't found. And the landslides that originated in buffers did deliver significantly more woody debris than landslides outside of buffers. It's important to remember that landslides are a historic disturbance mechanism. They bring wood and sediment into streams. It's important for fish habitat. And if it goes, that landslide goes through a buffer, it tends to bring in that wood and probably doesn't travel as far, although that wasn't part of this study. Aaron asked me to talk about public safety versus public resources. So in this study, we did not set out to look at public safety. We were identifying all the landslides that delivered to a public resource, and we were looking at the landslide initiation point. And Aaron asked if we could go back to our data and look at four public safety issues. Could we mine this data set and learn something about the effect of forest practices and landsliding on public safety? And one of the problems we have is we focused our blocks in areas with commercial forests, a lot of commercial forests. Our blocks do not intersect areas with people and houses or actually major roads for the most part. And so I did go through our data set, and there's just very few places where we have, yeah, I don't think there are any houses in our entire study area and very few major roads. Most of our roads are forest roads. There are data sets, you saw this earlier, there are data sets where, you know, public safety was an issue. There were public safety issues potentially in that 2007 storm. We just, our data set isn't appropriate to evaluation of those. And with that, I guess we'll take questions if you, or wherever you want.
Questions? Board Member Sabine.
So the areas that slid on non-rule identified landforms, did you take a closer look at what those landforms were or how they can be better identified in the future? Or let me rephrase that. Is there something that can be learned from your study about those particular landforms, or is more work needed to figure out how to avoid harvesting there in the future?
CMER has a study queued up to look at the criteria for unstable slopes. And that study would look at whether there are other criteria that could be used, whether we could refine the criteria to capture more of those landslides that are outside the current rural identified landforms. That would probably not be based solely on this study. This study is regional look, effectively. But, yeah, that is planned.
And if I recall, Jim, that was part of the policy committee's recommendations to the board at the February meeting around it.
And you probably, if you've looked at your full board packet, you'll have seen that on the project list. It was called Unstable Slopes Criteria Evaluation Project, I believe.
Questions on mass wasting effectiveness report? So tell me, study design wise, I know that you didn't look at particular FPAs. If we were to, is there any benefit to going back and looking at the 40% of slides that originated from no particularly identifiable landform? I understand that we've got further inquiry that's already designed a bit in CMER, but was there some quantitative observation that can be made from those sites, or is it a difficult thing to do after the fact, or?
So we mapped just the initiation location, and you can go back and look at the properties after the fact of those places and try to find some set of common, characteristic that we could use to identify those types of places in other parts of the landscape. And I think that will be part of what happens under the criteria is looking at not just that data set, but other data sets where we already have good inventories of landslides and looking for commonalities that are currently outside the rural identified landform.
Other questions? Seeing none, our next important job is to go get some sustenance. So let's, without objection, we'll break for lunch, come back at 1 o'clock.